Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with internationally acclaimed pianist Rudolf Buchbinder, who's playing Mozart with the San Francisco Symphony under Michael Tilson Thomas this week. Also talk with Nick Ishimaru, Artistic Director of Theater of Yugen, which presents the West Coast premiere of The Red Demon. You'll also hear about pop-up opera performances at the Oasis, collaborations with the San Francisco opera artists for a night of opera, drag, and debauchery, hosted by legendary drag artist Heckling Sean Waugh, who takes care of the opera outside activities, will be in studio to talk about that event. You'll also hear about the Open Studios event from Joanne Madonna, Executive Director of Arts Band, to talk about the 41st annual San Francisco Open Studios all throughout the city. Stay with us. San Francisco's Theater of Yugen gives West Coast audiences their first look at The Red Demon, a modern drama by acclaimed Japanese playwright Hideki Noda. It'll be directed by Theater of Yugen Artistic Director Nick Ishimaru, who's making his directing debut with this project. He is Theater of Yugen's Project Director and current Interim Artistic Director, who has also directed several other productions, both here and for Colorado State University, the University of Hawaii, San Francisco State, and as well as the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Nick, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy to have you here. Well, first of all, I'm pleased to discover Theater of Yugen. I didn't know that much about this company, and it's been around for 35 years.
Actually, a little bit longer than that. We're going into our 38th season right now. We were founded in 1978 by Yuriko Doi, who is an astonishing woman who came here from Japan to pursue a career in creating contemporary art using traditional forms. She has a background in both no and kyogen, which are theater forms that have existed continuously for over 400 years. They are the oldest continuously performed theatrical traditions alive today. And she moved here in the 70s wanting to pursue a career because at the time, women were not allowed to be professionals in the traditional arts in Japan. And so her teacher told her that if she wanted to have a flourishing career because she had the talent and the drive and the skill to do so, that coming to America would be the right idea. So she came here and with several students from San Francisco State University created the Theater of Yugen, which was dedicated to taking these traditional art forms, which are heavily physical art forms, and creating new experiences based on the conventional patterns and performance styles of those forms.
Is that what the Yugen style means then?
Yes, Yugen is grounded very heavily in a physical theater tradition, and even when we're not doing work that is completely based in traditional Japan, like the Red Demon, we still try and use as many different kinds of physical performance techniques or dance styles as we can to create a performance that is grounded entirely in the body and relies less on an audience's preconceived notions of what theater should be.
You've directed several traditional kyogen plays at the Theater of Yugen. What does that style mean?
Well, I've been in several. Usually Yuriko Doi is directing, or sometimes a longstanding company member Sheila Barati is directing those. Kyogen is an old form of satire. Like I said, it developed in the 1400s. And it is... There are plays based in human life, human stories, and every play always begins with someone walking out on stage and saying, I am a man from this area, or I'm a person from this area. And then they relate some sort of silly contrivance that's occurred, like, I have some business I have to attend to on the other side of the mountain, and so I will leave my servants in charge of the house. And then you get your setup, and comedy spirals from there.
Of course, yeah.
Of course.
So before we talk specifically about The Red Demon, give us a brief snapshot of playwright Hideki Noda.
Oh, wow. Hideki Noda was a playwright who became very prominent in the late 1970s and early 80s in Japan, and he was known for his frenetic, almost carnivalesque style of writing. The Japanese language is something that we would call rhyme rich and sound poor, meaning there's a whole bunch of homonyms, and the language has developed into humor in Japanese language has developed on puns and on multiple entendre and multiple meanings. And so when he developed his style, he would write plays that were almost unintelligible because of all of the different levels of punning that would occur, that any given word could actually mean six or seven different things depending on the context. And the plays flew by so quickly that it was impossible to glean what context that was, and so it would leave the audience sort of in the dust, bewildered by what they had seen. And so
that's interesting you should say that, because a good friend of ours teaches at Montreal, Greg Robinson, who's an authority on Japanese culture and especially the World War II era of incarceration of the Japanese American. And he's always been a great punster. I mean, always bad pun. So I'm wondering if that he's encountered the same thing when he's gone into his Japanese phase.
I would not be surprised to find that. To this day, Japanese humor relies heavily on punning. And even in Japanese theater, there are entire sections dedicated to wordplay and interchanging of words and interchanging of parts of words to create whole new meanings out of things, sometimes silly meanings, sometimes very profound ones. And The Red Demon, actually, it was a later play by Noda Hideki. It was written in the mid-1990s after he had started to gravitate away from his carnivalesque style and wanted to write plays with a more serious political message. So The Red Demon was one of his very first attempts at writing a play that had a profound moral story to it. But obviously his carnivalesque and pun style is still very apparent in the play, and it comes to life throughout. So the play on its face looks like a comedy from start to almost the end, when it sort of whiplashes into a terrific tragedy. So I like to describe this as a tragic comedy, because there's really no better way to discuss it.
Well, perfect segue into discussing somewhat a little bit of a synopsis of what's going on. So a stranger washes ashore, basically.
Yeah, so this creature washes ashore in this tiny beachside town. And it doesn't seem to speak a language, and it doesn't understand human customs, and no one in this small village can understand what it is. And so, because it's very dark red, it seems to be burned or something, everyone in town assumes that this creature is a demon. And as all demons do, it must eat people. And so the only reason this creature could be here is because it has come to devour everyone in town. So the story begins to spiral wildly out of control in the first 5-10 minutes as everyone just makes all these assumptions about what this creature is, and the story about what it looks like grows and grows and gets more and more elaborate and more out of hand, until finally we as an audience get to really start interacting with the demon and figure out what it is and where it has come from. And our voyage is guided by two characters, one person only referred to as that woman throughout the play, who's sort of an outcast in the village, and people revile her and treat her very poorly, and they say really horrific things about her. And because of her outsider status, she begins to try and understand what this creature is and where it has come from. And the audience's real window into the show is her idiot brother, her older brother, who is clearly a half-wit and doesn't really understand anything about what's going on. And so his naivete allows us to approach this creature very innocently and watch these things from a detached perspective and watch the play unfold.
Well, tell us about your cast members in those two roles.
So playing that woman is Ayelet Furstenberg, who is a phenomenal actress. She's a real powerhouse on stage and brings a wonderful vibrancy and energy to everything that she does. She was recently in The Wild Party with Ray of Light. She hails from a number of different places, but she has prominence both in New York and L.A. She has won awards for her performances down in L.A. as well. She has a huge background in musical theater, but clearly tackles contemporary drama very effectively. The actor playing her brother is Stephen Ho, who has only been involved in theater for a couple of years now, as it turns out. But he has brought some skill and grace and a real sensitivity to the stage that is very refreshing to see, and his natural talent is very inspiring. And he presents this very soft, almost childlike character who is bewildered and glowing about everything that he sees, and is just the life that he manages to infuse into this fairly flat character is wonderful to watch.
Did Noda write this in Japanese originally or English?
So it's actually really interesting how this play is originally written. The character of the Red Demon is written in three different languages. The base play is written in Japanese, so there are four actors throughout the show, one playing the Red Demon, and then three other actors who tackle about 30 roles across the show, and all of their lines are all in Japanese. But the actor he originally had to play the demon was an actor from Ireland, and so the script was written in Japanese with large segments in English, and then it was all translated into Irish so actor could perform it, because they wanted to create a thing that couldn't be understood by an audience.
I was going to say, that's the way to go with Irish.
Exactly. And so we've actually been trying to recapture that feeling with our production and trying to figure out, like, well, what languages can we use, especially here in the Bay Area, because people are so multi-ethnic and multicultural, and we're really used to hearing a whole wide variety of languages. And so longtime Theater of Jugend company member Luis Vise has returned to us and is delivering most of the show in his native language, Catalan, because he's from Barcelona.
Hmm.
And we were trying to figure out if that would be removed enough from Spanish that it would sound like perhaps this creature was trying to communicate, but nobody would really be able to understand it. And I think we found a pretty good balance with that.
Interesting. And what has who has it fallen on to translate the main part of the play to English? Is that Noda's translation?
The translation was actually written by a gentleman named Roger Pulvers. It was translated first for publication in a play anthology, and then it was translated again by the same gentleman for its professional debut in London. So we're using the original published version that Roger Pulvers translated. It retains more of the puns and more of the language humor than the London version did. So we wanted to play with that a little bit more.
And what will we see on stage? Is it what period are you setting the play in?
So the play is we were following a Brechtian suggestion of undating a piece, and it doesn't really take place at any specific time. We make references to technology. We use impromptu cell phones. There's text messaging in the piece, but we make references to people like Lady Gaga and Anton Scalia. One of our actors is quite fond of making references to Prince, and so these kinds
Scalia isn't the monster that comes ashore.
Not this time. he does come back from the dead to eat a calf, but that's later for the show. We have all of these contemporary references, but the style is non-culturally specific, and our wonderful costume designer Liz Brent has created a style that is woven together from different pieces. So she took a bunch of garments, distressed them, and then restitched them back into separate clothes. So we have sort of a timeless, non-specific setting. Our goal in doing so was that we would create a scenario where we could see really how humans in general interact with the unknown, and how we react to fear and stimuli that we aren't familiar with, rather than trying to create a very contemporary American play. We wanted to do something that was much more universal.
Well, a timely topic indeed, given the whole world's refugee crisis at the moment, the fear of something coming ashore.
Exactly.
And not knowing what that thing is going to be doing.
Exactly. It was one of our primary inspirations for the play.
Whether they're coming, why they're coming, and then the whole issue of acceptance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, you did mention that there's some interesting musical selections that have been chosen. We're going to go out with some Lady Gaga. What else is in the show that you're going to look forward to?
In the show, the music is either ambient or it's actually traditional Catalan folk songs that Lluís Vise has come up with. We're using a lot of the other more contemporary music for our pre-show and intermission music. So something to help set the mood and help get audiences right in that mental space to be able to witness this event.
Very nice. The play is The Red Demon. Nick Ishimaru
mm-hmm.
is the director of the show. It's at No Space, presented by the Theater of Jugend. The No Space is at 2840 Mariposa Street here in San Francisco. For more information, theaterofjugend.org. That's Y-U-G-E-N, theater with an R-E, theaterofjugend.org. The show runs through November 13th. Thanks so much for coming in, Nick. We look forward to catching the show. And here's a little Gaga to take you out. Lady Gaga singing Monster, appropriate for the production of The Red Demon, presented by the Theater of Yugen through November 13th by Hideki Noda. Thanks again to Nick Ishimaro for stopping in and talking about that play. It's a great segue, Monster, that is, for our next sequence. For Gals, Ghouls, and Divas in Drag abound at the next San Francisco Opera Lab pop-up at Oasis here in San Francisco. You'll hear some San Francisco opera singers on the eve of Halloween for some operatic, let's call it debauchery, with a touch of drag, macabre. You can grab a cocktail and work on your lip-syncing skills along with the hostess, with the mostess, Hecklina, one of the great drag sensations and treasures here in San Francisco. Hecklina is the stage name of Stefan Grigelko, who founded Tranny Shack, now called Mother. He's an American actor and entrepreneur here in San Francisco, who's a co-owner of the Oasis. Here to talk about that event is Sean Waugh, who also is in charge of all the external things that happen with the San Francisco Opera. Sean, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much, David.
Of course. Well, this sounds like so gosh darn much fun. Who came up with the idea?
Yeah, sure. So SF Opera Lab was launched in January of this year, and it's our alternative programming arm for the company, launched really as a result of the opening of the Wilsey Center for Opera, which is a new space located in the Veterans Building in Civic Center. And we have a new small theater in there, and we needed to explore alternative programming ideas and more experimental programming as well.
Sure, it's a great space up there for, but it's also limited too. So you're
that's right
reaching out a little bit for
that's
this
right.
event.
And so, as we were developing programming for this new arm, we started to also see that SF Opera Lab could live outside of the Wilsey Center. And so, SF Opera Lab pop ups are our exploration of that. And we've had two thus far, and the next one is on Sunday at 7 p.m. at Oasis.
So who is the brainchild behind this Halloween-themed and then involving Hecklina with the opera artists?
Yeah, so it's really a project that we've kind of been talking about for a while. Is wouldn't it be great to explore a show combining drag and opera? And drag has such an interesting connection to opera in the sense that oftentimes when you do go to the opera, you'll see productions that feature ladies in what we call trouser roles, and so they're mezzo sopranos or sopranos singing roles that are men on stage, and sometimes
true
they
enough,
even
yeah.
dress up on stage in drag
yeah,
to
yeah.
be a woman.
Right. Well, look at all the Handel operas.
exactly. Or Marriage of Figaro with the role of Cherubino.
Yeah.
And so it's something that we had been talking about for a while, and so our team, we have a small planning team at the company that I work and kind of lead and help produce. And so this idea was something that we all kind of came together on over the last few months. And we're so excited to be exploring this because it's really pushing us outside of our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got quite a cast that are going to be showing up for the operatic end of things, including Julie Adams, mezzo-soprano Renee Rapier.
Yeah.
Tenor Brenton Ryan and bass baritone Brad Walker, along with current Adler fellow pianist Jennifer Zeto.
That's right.
So Julie Adams, I know we saw in the Macropolis case this year. She's going to be Kate Pinkerton and Madama Butterfly and then Mimi in La Boheme. She's a second-year Adler fellow. Tell us a little bit about Brenton Ryan, the tenor.
Sure. So Brenton is currently in Macropolis case as well, playing Yannick. And that's the role opposite of Julie Adams, actually.
Right. Oh, right.
And he's making his San Francisco Opera debut, and the final performance is on Saturday night. We just had a really great performance last night. And this, having Brenton involved in this project is really exciting. He's not an Adler fellow or a former Adler fellow, so it's exciting to be involving one of our main stage artists in this project.
Fantastic.
And he's going to be exploring some of he does a lot of character tenor roles, and so we'll have some really great fun pieces for that night, including The Witch from Hansel and Gretel.
Oh, nice, yeah. Nice. So tell us how else is opera interweaving with the show?
Sure. So we will be incorporating a lot of opera throughout the night and exploring the connections not only to making connections to the drag community and to how drag is incorporated into the art form. But also, since it is Halloween Eve, we'll be incorporating a lot of references to Halloween or death and macabre themes, and that will also be explored in the operatic repertoire that will be featured that evening.
And that's this coming Sunday night. You're encouraged to come in costume, or actually there'll be some costumes provided by the San Francisco Opera Costume Shop.
That's right, yeah. So we have an amazing costume team at the company, and we're really excited to have some of our costumes featured at this event. And so anyone that comes in can certainly try on one of the costumes or take advantage of some of the props from our operatic prop department. And there'll be a photo booth, and folks can get dressed up and take a photo and post that on social media and get hopefully a lot of attention.
Neat.
Yeah.
What's coming up after this for the Opera Lab?
Sure. So we've got a really exciting season that's going to launch in 2017. We're presenting the San Francisco premiere of Ted Hearn's The Source, which is a piece that's really quite striking and is exploring the themes around Chelsea Manning and WikiLeaks. And it's almost an oratorio in a way with a very modern and relevant theme, and that will be presented in February, March. And then we will also be bringing back Anna Caterina Antonacci, who was last featured here in Troyen as Cassandra, and then also in the world premiere of La Chochara, or Two Women, in the title role there. And she's a outstanding international star, and she'll be coming in to present Poulenc's La Voix Humaine, and in a really exciting new interpretation that will be featured in the Wilsey Center in the Toby Atrium Theater. So we're excited about that as well, and a few other projects that are not yet announced, but we're really excited to feature them really soon.
Neat. Let's just back up then to this coming Sunday's Drag Queen of the Opera event one more time, and just tell us a little bit about more of the singing. Folks that are involved. Renee is Rapier.
No,
from Marion, Ohio. She's singing, sang Mercedes and Carmen last season, right?
That's right.
And what else is she? She's an opera fellow, Adler fellow from 2012-13.
Yeah, she's a former Adler fellow, lives here in the Bay Area, so we're really thrilled that we're able to have some of our former Adlers around to keep using them for projects, and she's going to be great in this production. She's a mezzo soprano, so she'll be singing all of the trouser roll features, and that's really something that she shines in, and it's going to be really entertaining as well. And there'll be even a little bit of Carmen in there as well.
Nice. Well, you got to have a little Carmen in
there,
of course.
Yeah.
we'll discuss who's going to be the bull or the gourd person in later. This is going to be with Heclina. Heclina is just a treasure. She continues to host special events throughout San Francisco for a variety of community and charitable events, and she was community grand marshal of SF Pride back in 2004. She was sainted by the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Saint Heclina. I won't say the innocent, but nonetheless, Heclina is going to be up front and center this Sunday, October 30th. Doors open at 7 at the Oasis here in San Francisco. We want to learn more about the information about this particular event, sfopera.lab.com. It'll also show you a lot of things that are coming up, exciting things that are happening through SF Opera in their brand new space as part of the Veterans Memorial Building. Jean-Wa, continue to wow us with your fantastic programming, and we'll have you back again soon.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, we'll be talking with Rudolf Buchbinder about his performances with the San Francisco Symphony and information about Open Studios and ArtSpan coming up here on Open Air. Stay with us. Now, a special treat. Oh, Gotta love that mashup of Mick and the Queen of the Night, Edson Cordeiro, Brazilian drag artist from many years ago, and Cassia Eller in that mashup. Won't necessarily hear that this coming Sunday for Drag Queen of the Opera, but nonetheless, Heklina and artists from the San Francisco Opera will be giving you an evening you will not soon forget. Come in costume, or they'll have costumes for your taking, for wearing that night, and a chance to win some SF Opera Lab swag and tickets. And also, so there'll be some dancing afterwards, so be sure to bring your dancing shoes for a live DJ following the performance at the Oasis. Information at sfopera.lab.com. Well, the 41st annual SF Open Studios event is underway. Joan Madonna, Executive Director of ArtSpan, is here to talk about the many things that have been going on and continue to go on. It's going to be quite an interesting way to negotiate the so many things that are going on. Joan joined ArtSpan staff back in 2014 as the Interim Executive Director and has served on the board since 2013. She's been affiliated with ArtSpan as an artist participant herself in 2003 and a host of her husband, Paul Madonna, SF Open Studio, since 2004. So nice to have you on to talk about it. And I'm just looking through the catalog. There's so much going on here.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here.
Help us navigate the SF Open Studios.
SF Open Studios was started by artists themselves 41 years ago with the idea of the best way to inspire those who appreciate art and to get them to know about art is to bring them into the studio, the place where art is actually made, and to talk directly with the artist, see the materials, and see works in progress. And it was so successful after a couple of iterations that they grew it from one weekend to two, which now it's a month-long event. We have over 800 artists citywide that participate, and artists love it, and art appreciators love it. And to help navigate that, ArtSpan became a nonprofit about 15 years after the event was started. And the most important thing we do is we make an SF Open Studios guide that is really a catalog of local arts all year round. People carry it around like a Bible. They dog-ear it. They keep it under their arms. You see people out and about throughout the city all month long. And really, it ends up in the, you know, on the coffee tables of people all year long if they want to shop for art for birthdays or holidays or, you know, they have new things in their house they want to add some art to. And it's pretty much the primary tool that we have, but we also have an online guide, we have an online map, we have an app, trying to get everything we possibly can so people can connect themselves directly to the artist and the art.
And if you are an artist here in San Francisco that is interested in participating in Open Studios, how does that happen? Is there a process? Is there a panel that goes through? And
no, there isn't. Actually, we are an all-inclusive organization, and really you become a member at a $30 level right now. And with the $30 level, you become an ArtSpan artist member, and you are able to participate in all of our programs, including Open Studios, which is a seasonal event that is happening right now. When I stepped over to be the executive director, I realized that as wonderful as Open Studios is, and it really is a fantastic event, 90,000 people participate and go and visit studios throughout the year.
Oh my gosh.
Which is really amazing. And I just thought we need to do more than just one weekend in order to really help our artists locally. And how can we do that? We need to have year-round programs, year-round exhibitions, year-round shows out and about throughout the city. And at that $30 level, the artists are able to submit to all of our shows all the time. And we also have workshops that help with professional development for artists, which I think is key to help them be professional businesses. And then if they want to participate in Open Studios, there's an additional fee because we pull all that money together for the guide, which is a gorgeous, like I said, year-round catalog of art. We also buy, you know, Muni ads. We are able to kind of take that money and promote far and wide for everyone to know what's going on and to find themselves with artists that they like and to go visit studios that appeal to them.
That guide is at artspan.org. You can get a hard copy as well upon request. We're already in the third weekend. So what were some highlights for you for the first two?
You know, the first weekend this year, as it has been the past couple of years, is the Hunters Point Shipyard Artist. It's a wonderful colony of about 300 local artists that have produced work out there for over 30 years. And it's always a really fun event. There's several buildings. There's food trucks. We have a Youth Open Studios site there as well on Saturday. We also have family art-making activities to make sure that families bring their children and get exposed to art at a very young age. And we love starting the season with that at this point. Last weekend was kind of an East Side experience. We had studios open all the way from Fort Mason Center through North Beach, through South of Market, all the way down through Dog Patch and into the Bayview. And there's just wonderful range of sites from Fort Mason, which is a city-owned building, to Yosemite Place. There's SF Clayworks. There's Public Glass. I mean, pretty much any type of medium you appreciate or you want to see, photography, painting, prints, it exists.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give a special shout-out to a friend of mine that's going to be exhibiting her painting, Sandra McPherson, on Castro Street. She can be found this coming weekend. Might be a little soggy weekend. Well, I can hope for some good weather. We'll see what happens.
You know, it's hard to complain about the rain, right? We're all happy for the rain.
We are.
And I say, what better thing to do than to go inside and look at art inside during the rain? You just have to run from the car or the Munis directly into the studios and take an umbrella.
Well, not even. I mean, it's only water, for gosh sakes,
right? It is. It's only water. And we need the water.
And we need watercolors, don't we?
We need watercolors. Just don't let them run. And, we try to do a lot to promote all year long, and especially the week of leading up to each one. Before the first weekend at Hunter's Point, we knew the rain was coming. And we go and find an artist that has, rain-themed work. Look, an umbrella in a painting. Hey, rain or shine, come out and see art. And I really, San Francisco is tricky. There's a lot to do and see at any point. And sunny days, people want to be outside. Rainy days, people don't want to go outside. So I just try to say, really, get out, support the arts, meet the artist, be inspired, and don't let the rain stop you.
Joan Madonna, Executive Director of ArtSpan, thanks for coming in today. And for more information, go to artspan.org for the fabulous catalog and a guide. There's still plenty to do in these next two weekends from 11 to 6 in all sorts of neighborhoods here in San Francisco. Art of every variety at your fingertips. It is getting to be holiday season, folks. Might be a good time to consider the gift of art for friends.
As I say all the time, the best way to support local art, buy the work.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much.
Rudolf Buchbinder is going to be performing with the San Francisco Symphony this weekend. For more than 50 years, he's appeared in concerts all over the world with orchestras and conductors. And now in his 70th birthday year, he's on a whirlwind tour, celebrated in such venues as New York's Carnegie Hall, Suntory Hall in Tokyo, the Musikverein in Vienna, and the Berlin Philharmonie. Among highlights of his anniversary season are tours with the Vienna Philharmonic under the baton of Zubin Mehta and Franz Welser-Müst, with the Staatskapelle Dresden, as well as concerts with the Berlin Philharmonic led by Christian Thielemann. By invitation of Maurice Janssens, Mr. Buchbinder is artist in residence with the Bavarian Radio Symphony here in his 70th year. He is also featured in concerts at the Musikverein in Vienna, as I mentioned. His repertoire spans from Bach to contemporary music. He was last heard here in San Francisco in 1985. I got up with him at Davies Symphony Hall the other day, and forgive the noise, it was a very busy orchestral rehearsal day, and you'll hear some folks chatting in the background a little bit. But here is my talk with Rudolf Buchbinder. Rudolf Buchbinder, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
You were born in 1946 in Leitmeritz, Czechoslovakia. Now, that was an area that was subsequently evacuated of Germans after World War II. Was your family at all affected by that?
Not at all. I have nothing to do with Czechs. I have nothing to do with the Germans. My family is from Vienna, and I just born there by chance.
And let's get right to the piano concerto. Of Mozart's 23 piano concertos, only two in minor keys, this one, number 20, in D minor, and a later one in C minor, this dating from 1785. Is this the D minor of Don Giovanni and the Requiem?
Yes, of course. It is quite a dramatic concerto. You know, Beethoven didn't like Mozart at all. Because when Beethoven came to Vienna, Mozart still was the god. It took Beethoven quite a long time to be as popular as Mozart, but he had a kind of connection to this concerto, therefore he wrote the cadenzas to this concerto. So he must have liked this concerto, Beethoven. It's a very dramatic concerto. For me, the most dramatic composer in any way is Mozart, and not Beethoven or any other. Mozart wrote Don Giovanni, as you mentioned, one of the most dramatic operas.
Now, as far as the cadenzas go, Mozart didn't write any cadenzas, most likely improvised them on the spot. Beethoven wrote cadenzas, as you mentioned, but also Clara Schumann, Busoni, Hummel. Are you using your own or one of these masters?
My principle is I try to play the original cadenzas by Mozart, which about the half of the concerti, he wrote the cadenzas, and to each movement sometimes two or three cadenzas. If there's no cadenza, I play my own cadenzas. I also forced my students not to play any other cadenza from anyone. You have to play your own cadenza. The exception is, of course, the D minor concerto, the Köchel 466, because the cadenzas by Beethoven are so fantastic, you have to play them.
And there's wonderful, we mentioned the Sturm und Drang nature of this D minor concerto, but wonderful relief in the romance movement and some wonderful interplay. I was listening in rehearsal between the winds and the piano in the third movement.
It's always a dialogue, you know, between the winds and the piano. It's concertare. Concerto means fighting. But at the end, we meet each other in friendship, of course.
You often perform these concertos as both pianist and conductor. Are you going to give Michael Tilson Thomas a break, perhaps?
No. He asked me also to. No. I love to play with Michael. It's wonderful to have a fantastic partner. To play and conduct, I'm unfortunately not the first one. Mozart did it, Beethoven did it, and many, many, many others as well.
But it also helps that MTT is a fine pianist as well.
Absolutely, he's a fantastic pianist.
He mentioned in rehearsal that it's so nice to play this with you, as it's almost as if you've been playing it all your life, and in fact, you have.
Oh, yes. I was the student at the university with age 5, the youngest student in Vienna. I couldn't read, I couldn't write, but I could play the piano. And the black and white keys are my partners all through my whole life.
I just came across the documentary Piano Mania, which features you as well as a number of other wonderful pianists. Unfortunately, the version I came across was es war in Deutsch und ich spreche nur schlecht Deutsch und verstehe nicht sehr gut.
But it's in a very interesting documentary with a genius piano tuner, Mr. Knüpfer. It's very interesting to look behind this screen of a piano tuning. Piano tuning has nothing to do with music. It's a different kind of hearing. For instance, I'm not able to tune a piano.
And that gets to the subject also of piano selection, and that's what was featured with the piano tuner in Piano Mania, is how pianists have to choose the right piano for the right music. What is your preferred instrument, and do you have a different brand preference for the different styles of music?
Look, first of all, if I choose a piano, this piano has to fit if I play Mozart, Gershwin, or Tchaikovsky, or chamber music. I always use the same piano. I need a very brilliant piano. I don't need it for the forte, it is brilliant. I need it for the piano. Otherwise, the piano sounds too dull. And I want to make the sound by myself, not the piano.
And does your choice also affect the size hall that you're playing in?
No, it has nothing to do. It must be as brilliant as possible to have all possibilities, all varieties of possibilities of colors and of dynamic.
Getting back to the fact that you played this for almost your whole life, how does your 70-year-old self playing this concerto compare to your 20-year-old self?
I think the freedom in the age is very important. The knowledge, which is growing and improving, in many, many years. And with this knowledge, you are able to be free. You cannot be free without knowledge. Knowledge makes you free. And therefore, I think as a young person, you are you are not flexible. You are intolerant against any kind of rubato. And you're in my age now. When I read the books about Mozart and Beethoven, Beethoven has changed the tempo in a movement several times, what we don't do today, actually. So this kind of little freedom is very important.
This also brings up the matter of keeping a balance in programming between the young hotshot pianist that comes out and is playing Mozart's 20th at the age of 12 and is making a tour of it, versus someone that brings a breadth and a depth of knowledge?
Look, there are some things which are amazing. For instance, I never listen to my own recordings. They are in the original package, and they are just at home, and that I don't touch them. But what is interesting for myself, to listen when I was a boy. And that few weeks ago, I listened to a recording. When I was 8 years old, I played a study by Chopin. And I was shocked that as a young boy, how perfect your instinct is. So instinct is very important also in music. And then you grow and grow, and you are thinking and working and thinking and discovering and everything. You should never lose the instinct, which is very important.
This your 70th birthday, you're celebrating as a way of just touring all over the world, some of the great capitals of the world, a whirlwind tour, in fact. How are you resisting the temptations of these wonderful cities and maintaining a tour schedule in your health?
First of all, I know all the cities. Every year I'm in Japan or in China. You know all the cities. I have no problem with traveling. Jet lag is a little problem. People say for each hour you need one day. It's true. But sleep is the most important thing on tour. And thanks God, I got this present to sleep at any time I want.
That's wonderful. Well, we certainly won't be sleeping through the performances this week of the Mozart number 20 in D minor. Also on the program, Brahms' Second Symphony. Should be a wonderful performance, and we thank you for taking a little time. Let's make it a return visit sooner than 20 years, huh?
Yes, thank you very much. I love San Francisco. The orchestra is fantastic. I like MTT. We know each other very long, long time.
Rudolf Buchbinder, who's performing this weekend with Michael Tilson-Thomas, tonight, in fact, at 8. Information at sfsymphony.org. Let's hear a little bit of the great Rudolf Buchbinder performing Mozart's 20th, which will be on the program.
Thank you.
Rudolf Buchbinder, at the piano and conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. He's performing the Mozart Concerto No. 20 in D minor, Kerschel 466, with Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony this weekend. sfsymphony.org for more information. It'll be a great concert. Also on the program, the Gregorio Allegri's piece, and that will be which was composed in the 1630s, and the Pacific Boy Choir will be featured for that. And the Mozart on the program, along with Brahms Symphony No. 2, should be a great program. Also, next week is the last chance you have to catch the San Francisco Symphony before their big grand tour of Asia. They're going to be in Seoul, South Korea on the 9th and 10th of November, in Taiwan on the 12th and 13th, Shanghai, China, as well as Beijing throughout mid-month, and then ending up things at the end of November in Japan before they join us once again here in San Francisco. That tour will be featuring pianist Yuja Wang in this 10 concerts over 6 cities through the 22nd of November. Information, all things San Francisco Symphony, at their website, sfsymphony.org. Let's continue with a little Mozart to finish things out. Here is a continuation of Buchbinder at the piano and conducting the Vienna Philharmonic and the Mozart Sturm und Drangisch Concerto No. 20. Written 1785, it was a time just around the time that Haydn had mentioned to Mozart's father, "I say to you before God and man that your son is the most brilliant composer," etc., etc. And this was one of the works that he had heard.
Thank you.
Pianist Rudolf Buchbinder with the Vienna Philharmonic, also conducting that fine orchestra. You can catch him performing that Mozart Piano Concerto No. 20, Kürschel 466, this weekend with the San Francisco Symphony.